Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Craig Servillo, host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Hope M. Harrison about her excellent new book, After the Berlin Wall, Memory and the Making of New Germany, 1989 to the Present. Dr. Harrison, hello and welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Yes, it's a pleasure to have you on today. And Dr. Harrison, as a matter of introduction, could you please tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a professor of history and international affairs at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. I've been there for 20 years, and I teach classes on the Cold War, on Germany, Russia, and uses and misuses of history in international affairs.
Oh, fascinating. Where did you get your PhD?
So I got my PhD at Columbia and my bachelor's at Harvard, where my interest in all of this began.
And is this your second book, third book?
Yes, this is my second book. The first book, I seem to be obsessed with the Berlin Wall. I just find it absolutely fascinating how on earth a city could be divided by a wall. And that interest began in college when I took a course on Soviet foreign policy and learned about the history that led up to the building of the Berlin Wall. And I wanted to learn more. So I learned Russian first and studied the Soviet Union. At that point, it was the end of the Cold War, and they were, you know, had been our adversary. So I wanted to know more about them. And then the more I studied, I focused on Soviet policy toward Germany and ultimately on the Berlin Wall. So then I learned German also. And my first book was about the building of the Berlin Wall in 1961. And the second book that we're talking about today looks at how Germans look back on that period of their history, the 28 years when the Berlin Wall stood.
Can you give us the title of your first book for those that might be interested?
The first book is called Driving the Soviets Up the Wall. What comes after the colon is Soviet-East German relations from 1953 to 1961. And for that, I kept flying back and forth between Moscow and Berlin in the 1990s using the archives. So it was the first book to be able to tell the true story of the communist decision to build the wall in 1961.
Well, thank you for letting us know about that. I'm sure there'll be listeners that would be interested in to know about the building. So you sort of addressed this a little bit, but I'm very curious as to the origin stories of this book. How did you come? You've mentioned your sort of career-long passion for this topic, but this particular book, particularly doing a sort of historical memory of it, how did you come up with the idea to do this?
Well, partly Berlin has really become a second home to me over the past 30 years. So I've spent much time there doing the research for my first book and then ultimately the second book, living in the city, watching the city come back together, watching what they did about commemorating people who were killed at the wall, watching how they handled anniversaries of the rise and fall of the wall. And that was coupled with my increasing interest in something that is incredibly topical in our country and our world right now in 2020, namely how nations deal with difficult aspects of their past. Obviously, right now, the issue is the Civil War and racism, which has been such a focus in the United States in the past couple of months and particularly the past few weeks. Views of history don't stay the same, and people and leaders often press through certain views of history at certain periods of time. And so I was curious to examine how have Germans and particularly German leaders in public spaces on major anniversaries, how have they treated the history of the wall? And has that changed over the past 30 years? So this broad interest in the sort of the intersection of history, politics, and culture, which we're going through right now in terms of racism in the United States, is something that I have looked at in my new book on the history of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful for us to begin with you anchoring us in some of the concepts of your book. How do you study historical memory sort of from a methodological standpoint? And I'm also very curious to have you describe to us what you mean or what a memory activist is. This is sort of the conceptual framework of your book, I think, will be important for us.
Thank you. Yes. Historical memory is how people, how groups, how nations, more than individuals. Obviously, those things are made up of individuals, but it looks in a broader perspective at how groups of people and nations judge or assess their past. How do they remember the past? What are the stories they tell about the past? What is the narrative? Which parts of the past do they focus on? And which others are they more quiet about? What do political leaders say on important historical anniversaries? What kind of narrative do they build around the past that then gets spread through the media to people? How is historical memory reflected in museums? You know, what artifacts people think are important enough to save and tell stories about? And even in popular culture, you know, how do you see, how is that history represented in books, in movies, in plays? So the concept of historical memory is a broad one and is essential to every nation, because every nation has a sense of where it comes from and what that means about who the people are now and who they want to be in the future. So essentially, historical memory is deeply entwined with a sense of national identity. Now, obviously, in most cases, countries want that national identity and historical memory to be positive, you know, things they're proud of in their history. It gets more complicated when they're dealing with things that are sort of black spots on their history. Most nations shy away from those. But Germany has been in a class almost by itself for dealing in a very forthright way with the most negative aspect of its past, namely the Holocaust. And so this study that I undertook with this book looks at how have they dealt with the history of the Berlin Wall.
And you mentioned, or you used the term memory activist. Can you describe to us what that is?
Yes, a memory activist is someone who feels strongly two things. Number one, that a certain aspect of history should be remembered. And number two, that it should be remembered in a particular way. And I guess number three, actually, in the case of my book, is that their views and their actions matter. They become part of the broader national historical memory, or what many people call collective memory. So I'm not looking at, you know, individuals who just talk to their family or friends and, you know, have their own views on the past, but aren't trying to get those across in a broader way in society. Looking much more at individuals whose actions ultimately have helped tell the story of the Berlin Wall in Germany.
And I mean, there's probably no way for you to answer this definitively, but do you have a sense of how many people, like a percentage of Germans that were sort of interested in this as an issue, the Berlin Wall? Did they have, I guess, an opinion poll, for the lack of a better phrasing?
Well, there have been certainly lots of opinion polls over time about how questions like, do you think it's important to remember this part of our history? Do you think it's important to preserve sections of the Berlin Wall? Now, in the early period after unification, so in the 1990s, there wasn't as much attention to this issue. The majority view early on was, you know, leave this in the past. It was a terrible thing. It divided us. The whole point of bringing it down in 1989 and then uniting Germany in 1990 was to, you know, come together. And this divided past is difficult to think about. It was painful. Let's leave it behind. And so that's really where my book begins, is with looking at some of the people who fought against that majority view and ultimately prevailed. But, you know, it took a long time. And it often does in nations that have difficult aspects of their past to grapple with. It often takes a generation till there's sort of more energy and willingness to look back at that difficult history.
Yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to ask that question was because I think one of the really interesting things about your book is it does a really good job of highlighting the sort of ebbs and flows of when this is important, when it's not so important, and so also the two sides. I didn't quite realize there would be such defined sort of almost camps over this issue. And so I think your book really highlights all of these things really well. And so I just wanted to give our listeners a sense of, you know, that this actually was a pretty important issue throughout the entire country. This wasn't just some niche group of people arguing over whether the wall should be preserved or not. This was something that people thought about. So I appreciate you taking a second to answer that. Now let's move to the sort of the first part of your book. This first chapter of your book is something I'm sure a lot of people aren't familiar with, and it was the trials a former East German border guards and some of their superiors. Can you give us a brief overview of these trials, just in a general sense, and why did they decide to have them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is part of the broad field of transitional justice. Of course, countries coming out of, you know, more authoritarian regimes as communist East Germany was. How do you handle what in a new, more democratic situation, you know, look to be crimes, but weren't exactly crimes when they were committed. So with the case of trials regarding the Berlin Wall, they were started when East Germany, the process was started when East Germany still existed at the very end in 1989, when people were demonstrating on the streets, calling for reform of the communist regime, calling for democracy, freedom of expression, freedom of travel, bring down the Berlin Wall. In particular, some parents of people who were killed at the wall, generally young men who were killed at the wall trying to escape, their parents brought cases against the East German regime. Well, Germany united less than a year after the fall of the wall, and so all of those cases were transferred to the new federal German state prosecutor's office. So it was families who now worked with lawyers and prosecutors on these cases. Now, the lawyers and prosecutors were, of course, all from West Germany because they had been trained in West German jurisprudence. East German communist law and lawyers and judges, you know, were discredited. So they weren't really part of this. So the trials went on for almost 15 years, actually. Most of them took place in the first few years in the 1990s. And these were trials both of the border soldiers who pulled the triggers, but also their military and political superiors for putting out the orders that the border soldiers then carried out. Now, these were obviously very emotional undertakings. The families of the plaintiffs, of course, were incredibly angry and wanted justice, as one of them said, for the cold-blooded murder of my son. And the lawyers used all the documents in East German archives, in the secret police archives, in the military archives, in the top party leadership archives, West German archives that tracked any information they got about people who were killed at the border. And so there was lots of evidence. And in most cases, particular border guards in each case confessed because, you know, all the documents were there. But it was a question of how individual border soldiers and their superiors responded in these trials and how the judges argued. Generally, the superiors, for the most part, tried to blame someone else. They basically said either or both, it was the Soviets. Don't blame us. You know, we had to follow what the Soviets said. And, you know, they dominated our side of the Cold War, the Warsaw Pact. You know, we were sort of just doing what they wanted, except that there was all sorts of evidence of the ways in which the East German regime themselves had come to a variety of independent decisions on the Berlin Wall at various points. So that didn't hold up very well, although they kept using it. Not a lot of them expressed a huge amount of remorse, which was really difficult for the families of people who had been killed sitting there in the courtroom, as was the case with Horst Schmidt, who I write a lot about, the father of Michael Schmidt, who was killed on December 1st, 1984, when he tried to escape. The judges ultimately ruled in the case of border soldiers, and in particular the case of Michael Schmidt, ruled that the border soldiers were guilty. And they got sentences of about 2.5 years, but the sentences were commuted because the judges said they did something wrong. There's no question they did it, but they were at the bottom of the command chain. And given that people at the very top were not speaking out against this, it's unfair for us to expect that people at the very bottom of the chain were acting against this. I guess the final point I'll make is that there were, though, all different kinds of reactions of border soldiers. I mean, some fired away from the people on purpose. Some people fired at their feet, you know, on purpose. Others fired many times at the torso. So, you know, you get very much a sense of the individuality of what the Berlin Wall meant, what the lethality of the Berlin Wall meant, depended, not surprisingly, very much on each individual border soldier.
And you mentioned that some of these border soldiers' superiors were tried. Were their sentences any different, better, worse?
The superiors generally got more higher sentences. So the entire communist leadership, the Politburo leadership, was put on trial in what were called the Politburo trials. So was the top military leadership. They got 4, 5, 6, 7 years in prison, but most of them were let out after a few years because of good behavior. Some of them were very old and in some cases got cancer. As in fact happened with the last leader of East Germany, Erich Honecker, who was the leader from 1971 until October of 1989, a month before the wall came down. He got liver cancer, and ultimately the court allowed him to leave, to not only to end the trial, but allowed him to go to join his wife and daughter in Chile, which completely outraged all the people who felt they had been victims of his regime, that he was getting better treatment than they ever got. So the highest sentence in the case of a border soldier was for someone who shot a border soldier who shot someone trying to escape after they had already surrendered and had their hands up in the air, and still he fired, I think, like 30 shots.
So much more egregious, obviously egregious, led to a longer sentence.
Yes.
Was there a tremendous amount of public interest in these trials? I can see, particularly for Honecker, there being an interest, but for the guards themselves, was this something that people paid attention to, read about? You know, certainly it was covered in the newspapers, but.
Yes. At first there was a lot of attention paid to it. you know, front page of newspapers, lots of coverage. But increasingly, other factors became more important, but also increasingly, particularly people in the former East, even those who had been very glad to get rid of that regime, started to feel like it was victor's justice. They started to feel that the entire East German system was being put on trial. Communism was being put on trial, which some people felt was unfair, particularly East Germans who in the 1990s lost their jobs as the country transitioned away from communism into capitalism and democracy. And, you know, people who had jobs in, you know, polluting, inefficient factories, producing shoddy goods, all of those were closed up and a lot of people didn't have jobs. And so they were pretty angry. They thought this unification was, you know, many people sort of dreamed, you know, we're all going to have Mercedes and BMWs like the West Germans and everything's going to be great. It's going to be easy. And when it turned out to, for some, particularly, you know, ages 50 and above, to be harder than they anticipated, they started to feel like they were all being scapegoated, including in these trials.
It probably didn't help that there were no East German lawyers, no East German judges, that they were entirely Western Germans conducting the proceedings. Yeah.
Yes.
Just one last thing on the trials and then we'll move on. What would you assess as the overall impact of these trials? Were they useful? Were they helpful? I mean, it sounds like the families wouldn't have said that they were, given the sort of the light sentences and a lot of people just getting out. But maybe more on a sort of macro level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, for history, which we historians care about, you know, establishing the record of exactly, you know, what the orders had been, including, you know, have to stop so-called border violators at all costs, even if they're women and children, you know, was in some of the orders. The fact that you got all this laid out, all this evidence laid out, you know, certainly brings about some of the truth, of history. But, you know, in terms of a sense of justice, you know, the overall impact that was certainly hardest. I mean, nobody, I think few Germans were really happy with the overall impact on feeling that justice had been done. You know, there were some people who felt, look, it's good. You know, we have called people to task. I mean, individuals have had to answer. But it also played into a narrative in parts of the former East that was sort of nostalgic, or what they called Ostalgie, nostalgia for the East, a sense of being judged.
Okay, so let's move on to the next section of your book. I was fascinated by sort of chapter two. First, can you tell us who Manfred Fischer was, and then we'll talk about religious institutions and their interest in this issue, because I found this fascinating.
Manfred Fischer was a pastor of a church right up against the Berlin Wall in West Berlin. He got there in 1975 and stayed there into the 2000s. So right outside of his parish window across the street was the Berlin Wall. And behind the Berlin Wall in East Berlin was the church he was supposed to be the minister of, the massive old, century-old Church of Reconciliation, built in the 1890s, a massive church. That happened to be on the border between two districts of Berlin, Wedding in the west and Mitte in the east. So when the Berlin Wall went up along that border, the church was in the death strip. It was boarded up. Nobody could go there anymore, even in the east. Border soldiers used it to look out. But ultimately, in the 1980s, in fact, in 1985, 4 years before the Berlin Wall was toppled, the East German regime decided to blow up the church and get it out of there. So that, it would, you know, no longer be kind of, this, not only symbol of hope to people in the West that they might one day have it back, but also, removed any obstruction of the views of the border soldiers looking, to see if anybody was trying to escape there. So Manfred Fischer had to set up, a room for worship in the parish building that was located in West Berlin. That had been built a few years after the wall went up, since they couldn't get to their church. And when the wall fell, Manfred Fischer was absolutely adamant, we have to preserve some of this wall right here on this street. The name of the street is Bernauer Straße. The wall essentially divided the street between east and west. And he literally at times during the craze of, you know, tearing down the wall in late 1989 into 1990, he literally stood in front of bulldozers saying, you are not taking this part of the wall. He said, this must be preserved. And I'll never forget when I interviewed him, he said to me, Hope, I felt that this was like a crime scene. And what do you do with a crime scene? You mark it off. You keep people away. You preserve it as it was to show the crime that occurred, meaning the killing of people for trying to get from East Berlin to West Berlin.
So that's what really drove him, was that he viewed it as sort of a crime scene.
Yes. And of course, he had his own personal history, that his own parish had been divided by it, and that, the big church, which older members of his parish had gone to when they were younger, and they could see, you know, the tall bell tower above the Berlin Wall. He saw how deeply grieved they were when that church was blown up and they realized they would never be able to go back to it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You do mention in the early part of that chapter that there were other religious institutions that were interested in the wall as an issue. Is this something that generally religious institutions took an interest in, or was it he and maybe the churches right around the wall was just a special case that they were in there because of their proximity? And as you mentioned, the connection to the building itself.
Yeah, this was a special case on Bernauer Strasse. It just happened. I mean, certainly churches in general were against violence and, you know, but, in this particular case, it's just really happenstance that on this street, first of all, that he took such a massive interest and kept pushing to preserve pieces of the wall and remember it. But it happenstance that on the exact same block where his parish building was, were two other religious institutions of one form or another. I mean, the one next to him, the Lazarus parish and hospital and basically assisted living care facilities, they had been looking out at the wall for the same number of years that Fisher had, but they came to the opposite conclusion. They said, you know, we had it for 28 years. We don't want to see it anymore. You know, and for old people who, you know, who have come to live out the final years of their life here, they definitely don't want to look out their windows and see the wall like they have. The other institution, the St. Sophie Church, its cemetery, part of its cemetery was on the ground where the East German regime had built the wall and the whole border strip that Manfred Fischer wanted to preserve. The East German regime had, in fact, removed graves. I mean, they had dug up bodies and moved graves to make room for the Berlin Wall. And so the people in that church were like, no, we don't want to keep the wall. I mean, it's outrageous they ever built it over graves to begin with. You know, let's get rid of it now. So it was happenstance that in the space of one block, there were three religious institutions, and, you know, it was essentially two against one, with Manfred Fischer being the one, but he just never gave up. And as times changed and political sensitivities changed, ultimately Manfred Fischer's view won out. And to this day, as I write about it, various chapters of the book, there is now the National Berlin Wall Memorial is, in fact, on that street. It is eight blocks along that street where they have preserved some sections of the wall, foundations of buildings that were destroyed to make room for the wall. They have highlighted places where people built tunnels under the wall. They've marked places where people were killed trying to escape. They have a massive outdoor exhibit there about the history of the wall and a small indoor museum that tells the history of that wall. And that is all because Manfred Fischer never gave up. And ultimately, politicians started coming there, which they do to this day. On August 13th, the anniversary of the building of the wall, and November 9th, the anniversary of the fall of the wall. That National Berlin Wall Memorial has been anchored into the collective memory of Germany in a very significant way.
Yeah, and for all our listeners who have not been to Berlin, and when this COVID is all over and you get a chance to travel again, it's definitely worth going to see in Berlin. It's a wonderful museum and a wonderful memorial.
Craig, let me just say that I actually made a few short video clips of myself on the grounds of the Berlin Wall Memorial, talking about it in the context of my book. So those exist as well to be viewed on the internet. You know, when you look up my book in Cambridge University Press, you should find those videos.
I was going to ask, was there somewhere specific they listeners could find them?
I
will post them in the show description.
Yes.
So you don't have to remember. I will do that for you. So don't, I didn't mean to put you on the spot there.
That's okay. Thank you.
Yep. So let's turn to the next section, on, the Checkpoint Charlie Museum. I'm sure that most of our listeners are familiar with Checkpoint Charlie is. But can you tell us about the museum? And it is a very interesting museum. And particularly some brief biographical information on the director of the museum, who gets very, very involved in this issue.
Yes. So Manfred Fischer is one memory activist I write a lot about. The director of the Checkpoint Charlie Museum, Alexander Hildebrandt, is another memory activist that I write a lot about. And by the way, we're coming up this month is the 30th anniversary of the removal of the Checkpoint Charlie checkpoint back in 1990 as part of the process of uniting Germany. So we're, you know, 30 years out from lots of these dramatic events. So Alexander Hildebrandt runs a private museum, so called the museum at Checkpoint Charlie. Now, her husband, Rainer Hildebrandt, is the one who opened up that museum in the mid-1960s. He actually first opened it on Bernauer Strasse, not far from where Manfred Fischer ultimately would become the pastor. And Rainer Hildebrandt wanted to showcase all the terrible things that were happening at the Berlin Wall. You know, he was from the West. He had been in the opposition to the Nazi regime, and now he wanted to really activate as many people as possible to draw attention to what a crime the Berlin Wall was. So he started collecting any artifacts he could, including how people escaped, whether it was by building an underground submarine, a hot air balloon, kayaking across water. He collected all sorts of these things, and in 1963 moved his museum moved his museum to the block where the Checkpoint Charlie crossing point was. So he always sought out lots of public attention to this. And once Germany united, he kept up this attention to remembering how terrible the wall had been. And when he died in 2004, his wife, Alexandra Hildebrandt, took over for him. And she, too, was very committed. And in particular, what I write about in this book was her response, what she thought Germany should do and Berlin should do to remember the Berlin Wall, and particularly to commemorate the victims. And that was on the 15th anniversary of the fall of the wall, in November of 2004. She unveiled outside on both sides of Friedrichstrasse, where the checkpoint had been, over 1,000 wooden crosses to people that she said had been killed at the Berlin Wall or the broader East German, West German border. And she said, basically, I'm filling in for where politicians haven't stepped up. There is no memorial to these people. There should be. And this is it. She had some family members of people who had been killed at the wall join her to unveil the memorial. She also pointedly said, again, this is 2004. She said, just a few blocks from here, they are building a Holocaust memorial. That Holocaust memorial was unveiled the following year in 2005. She said, just as there is that memorial, there also needs to be this memorial to victims of the East German regime, the communists, and the Berlin Wall. Now, this was very controversial to draw any comparison between the crimes of the Nazis and the crimes of the communists. She was trying to make the point that, you know, there also needs to be something to commemorate these victims. Now, even though Manfred Fischer had already begun his memorial to do this at Bernauer Strasse, she was critical of that. She said, you know, it's boring. It doesn't really capture the emotions there. It's not really in the center of things like we are here at Friedrichstrasse at what used to be Checkpoint Charlie.
And she even made this into a little bit of an international issue, right? She reached out to the Americans about this issue, and we responded. Yeah, can you tell us a little about that?
Exactly. Yes, she is associated with the conservative yet mainstream political party in Germany, the Christian Democratic Union, the CDU. You know, which is closest to the Republican Party in the U.S. And so she also knows people in the Republican Party and, you know, former diplomats, people who were in the military. And she understands very well the importance of publicity. And so she reached out to some of those people. And she also, surprisingly, reached out to the son of Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. Khrushchev is the one who was leader of the Soviet Union when the wall went up and who agreed to work with the East Germans, who had been pressing for it. The East German regime had been pressing for sealing off the border in Berlin. Khrushchev had agreed. Well, at the end of the Cold War, Khrushchev's son, Sergei, who looks very much like him, by the way, moved to the United States and was living in the United States, and she was in contact with him. And so he joined her also for the 15th anniversary of the fall of the wall in 2004 and the unveiling of her crosses. You know, he too said, yes, something should be done to remember victims of the wall.
Yeah, that's quite a powerful visual, I can imagine.
Yes.
I do want to ask, I want to go back to something you said a minute ago. It leads into my next question about this debate between Nazi history and wall history. I can totally see it being extremely controversial to sort of tie a link between the two. But this is something that, and you highlight this in the book, that goes back and forth, right? That
yes.
What history should be remembered and how it should be remembered and sort of at what level of classification that history. So can you, this is a little complicated. So can you sort of explain to us how this works?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what it comes down to is really a competition for attention and resources, meaning funding, a competition among victims. It's sad, but true. And Germany isn't the only country where this happens. So Germany, where the main focus has long been on the Holocaust and the Jewish victims, and then that expanded to other victims of the Nazi regime, Sinti and Roma, homosexuals, handicapped people. That looking at the Nazi past has been the focus of historical memory in Germany for good reason. So to have, with German unification in 1990, suddenly a whole new period of history, a whole new set of perpetrators and victims to think about, victims to commemorate, perpetrators to examine, investigate, analyze, has been a very emotionally fraught issue in Germany. Even when I was researching this book, I remember when I did interviews and I did, in addition to using lots of archival documents for this book and all sorts of speeches and Bundestag debates, I also did over 100 interviews with memory activists for this group. And I remember at the beginning, when I was working on this book in the 2000s, in the early 2000s, people, when I would start talking about the memory of the wall, some people would look at me like, why are you doing that? Why aren't you focusing on the Holocaust past? Why are you doing this? And they were definitely critical. And now these were people from the West who had long been schooled in the importance of atonement for the Holocaust and public memory directed to the Holocaust. So I remember being defensive and saying, you know, that's an incredibly important topic. And a lot of people have been working on that and are working on that. But, you know, there's also 40 years of East German history, 28 years of which the Berlin Wall stood. And that's what I'm working on. So there was a lot of defensiveness on the part, of course, of Jewish groups and other groups who had been victims of the Nazi regimes, but also politicians who felt, you know, the Nazi period has to be our main focus, with others saying, you know, wait a minute, this is also a really important part of German history. So there were Bundestag debates about this, which I write about. Lots of speeches, lots of newspaper articles, journal articles. I mean, this was a big public debate. And ultimately, because partly it comes to the question of money, how much money is going to go into preserving memorials of the Nazi period, like concentration camps, versus things that look at the East German regime? Like preserving pieces of the wall, preserving the Stasi prisons, the secret police prisons, where dissidents, including people who tried to escape and were caught, you know, were imprisoned because it was illegal. So, you know, it's about money to remember and attention of politicians. And this has been a very interesting, important debate that has taken place in Germany and is an ongoing debate. My book covers 30 years of that debate and the way in which ultimately the memory activists that I write about were able to push through and say, you know what? There also needs to be an important part of German public memory directed to the Berlin Wall. And that has occurred.
Yeah, let's sort of connect it to this. I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about how the wall is sort of represented in popular culture, film, art, photography, et cetera. And I'm obviously not, I'm not asking for the full breadth of it, of, you know, in every country and every place in the world, just more curious in sort of German popular culture.
Okay. Yes. Obviously it's in, you know, James Bond movies and others, Jean Le Carré novels. But in Germany itself, the wall wasn't very present in any direct way in popular culture while it stood. You know, one exception was the novel Peter Schneider wrote in 1983 called Wall Jumper that portrayed life in divided Berlin when he lived in West Berlin and often went to the East. But since the fall of the wall, there have been a variety of approaches. These have ranged from a novel written by Thomas Brussig in 1995 called Helden wie wir, Heroes Like Us. And this takes an incredibly satirical approach to the question of why did the wall fell? And particularly, who can claim credit? It pokes fun at the desire of many people to say, you know, I played a really important role in the fall of the wall. There has also been, in 2011, a musical that ran for 5 years in the heart of Berlin and Potsdamer Platz called Hinterm Horizont, Beyond the Horizon. That ultimately they developed English subtitles and people from all over the world went, as well as many people who had come from the East also went to see this musical. Fewer people from the West than from the East. And the musical, I was really impressed as a historian, began with a 5-minute black and white introductory film with historic footage of the Berlin Wall. And somehow over the course of 5 minutes, they did a great job of explaining the really brutal history of the Berlin Wall. So it was a little history lesson before then, you know, characters burst into song and, you know, lovers divided by the wall and, all of this. But more serious approaches have, in recent years, looked at the border soldiers themselves, because this has been the most controversial aspect of remembering the wall in any public way, other than the trials where they, you know, were being accused. In general popular culture, the understandable focus has been on the victims and the victims' families, people who survived, telling their story. Only in, you know, more recent years has the story of the border soldiers started to be told in a more in a way that humanizes them, which outrages still, you know, some Germans, but also, you know, tells the truth in the sense that if you want to understand how did this frontline border during the Cold War function, you have to understand the people who worked there, you know, the border soldiers, and who were mostly 18 to 21 and terrified of their superiors and often didn't realize that the Berlin Wall was in fact directed inwards. They always believed, of course, what they were told. It's the anti-fascist protective barrier. It's against the aggressive West, until they show up for work and they quickly realize it's directed against the East. So there have been a bunch of TV films, some shown on primetime television, that depict some cases at the border where people escaped or were shot trying to escape, but in fact put the focus on the border soldiers and sometimes even have them featured in the films. And having a border soldier agree to go on primetime public television in Germany and tell their story, you know, there are not a lot of them that are willing to do that. But some have, and that has been an important part of telling a more complete history of the Berlin Wall and remembering it in a more complete way.
You mentioned a little earlier that you did over 100 interviews. Did you reach out to any former border guards?
Yes, I talked to two or three of them. Yes. Now, I mean, the ones I spoke to are people who work with the National Berlin Wall Memorial that Manfred Fischer began. And so they obviously are people who are willing to, you know, as it were, out themselves. And so, you know, these aren't going to be the guys who, you know, are like, we did what was right. But in the indoor exhibit at the Berlin Wall Memorial, they do include quotes from multiple different border soldiers, including the ones who, you know, totally still believe what they did was right and necessary.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, I didn't think they would be lining up to talk about it, particularly because, you know, most of them, a lot of them are still alive. So I can mm-hmm. see that this history could still be quite raw. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the next part. So first, let's talk about what the freedom and unity movement is, and then have you explain the Peaceful Revolution exhibit.
So the Freedom and Unity Monument.
Apologize. Yeah, I think I said movement.
Yeah. This came from a variety of German, particularly members of the Bundestag, but it was started by others about 10 years after the fall of the wall to say, hey, we should have some monument in the German capital that celebrates the fall of the wall and German unification. This was a great thing, a turning point in German history, European history, and world history. They said, you know, we Germans were not usually good at celebrating things. We're so used to focusing on the terrible things we did in the Holocaust. But, you know, we should really, in the capital city where we have all these monuments to the Nazi period and to the East German secret police and to the wall, we should have a monument that celebrates freedom, meaning the freedom of East Germans, and the unity of all Germans. The Bundestag voted in 2007 to fund and support in every way such a monument. Well, now here we are in 2020. That monument was supposed to be built in 2009 for the 20th anniversary of the fall of the wall. It didn't happen. One thing after another has gotten in the way. And only this year has in fact construction begun in the center of Berlin for this Freedom and Unity monument at last. So that answers your first question. The second question is to talk about the Peaceful Revolution exhibit of 2009, which is tied up with the same kind of thinking that went into the desire, the Bundestag vote to create a Freedom and Unity monument. And this, let me say, this is kind of the turning point that I write about in my book, if you will, sort of the climax of the story in my book. which is about the 20th anniversary of the fall of the wall, marking a massive change in how Germany looks back at the history of the wall, and in fact, a massive change in a sense of German national identity from one focused on the negative side of the German past, the Holocaust, to one that says, you know, we will always focus on that, but we also can and should focus on happy history, good history, the fact that the wall fell peacefully, the fact that Germany united peacefully. These are extraordinary historical phenomena. And we can be proud of these things. And Germans, because of the Holocaust, do not use the word proud very often. But they started to do that in 2009. And a big reason for this change in the whole historical narrative, and what I call a new German founding myth established in 2009, came from one particular memory activist, Tom Zello, from the former East Germany, who had the idea to display an exhibit about the East German Peaceful Revolution of 1989. When tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of East Germans took to the streets in Berlin, Leipzig, and all over the country calling for change, and doing that in a very largely peaceful way. Tom Zello was, he had been a dissident in East Germany, and he felt he had been part of those demonstrations in 1989 in East Berlin. And he felt that people in United Germany didn't pay enough attention to this, that there was all this focus specifically on November 9th, 1989, the day the wall fell. He said that was in an important context, and that context was this peaceful revolution, the East Germans demanding change, including tear down the wall, let us have freedom of travel. So he put together an outdoor exhibit to show the history of these demonstrations, and ultimately got money from the Berlin Senate. And in 2009, for the 20th anniversary, this exhibit opened in the massive outdoor square Alexanderplatz. And that narrative of the agency of the East German people, you know, and essentially saying it was more than just the fall of the wall. The East Germans were demanding lots of changes. But also the wall didn't fall. That's so passive. Saying, you know, look, this was a peaceful revolution. The wall was toppled. And this basically, as I argue, became a new founding myth for United Germany. And this goes back, Craig, to where we started with you asking me the importance of historical memory. And, you know, for every nation, there are key moments in their history that they believe make them who they are today and moments they can be proud of. And in 2009, suddenly, really, the whole German elite, you know, mirrored all over the place in the media and all sorts of speeches by Angela Merkel and others in 2009 said, look, we as a nation were born from this peaceful revolution. This was our founding moment. And, you know, part of it was the fall of the wall. But it came out of this broader peaceful revolution. Essentially, it said, we Germans are now finally part of the community of nations we have long wanted to be part of. nations with democratic revolutions as their founding moments. And this narrative dominated in Germany for the 20th and the 25th anniversaries of the fall of the wall in 2009 and 2014.
Well, as a way to sort of close discussion on your book, and I'm not sure that was a great way to close the end of your book, but could you tell us and our listeners maybe one or two things you would hope that somebody listening to you today or and then hopefully going to read your book will take away from it, that will things that will stay with them?
Yes. I wish the book ended on that happy note, but the book ends, of course, with the 30th anniversary of the fall of the wall, which was last year, November 2019. And this year in October is the 30th anniversary of German unification. And over the past year, there have been lots of discussions in Germany about resentment some people in the East still feel about the challenges of essentially life in capitalism, challenges that, of course, many people around the world feel. But what I would like listeners to take away from my book is the understanding that the history of the Berlin Wall is, for many people in Germany, still a very emotional subject. And for some is even, you know, controversial. People's views of history change. And so, you know, a book like this can never be done. I mean, I look at, you know, the first 30 years of how Germans are thinking about this, but this is an ongoing subject.
And one last thing before I let you go. Now that this book is done, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on two things. The bigger thing is my next book will look at the border, not in Berlin, but on the Baltic Sea coast of East Germany. Because just like there was a militarized border with the Berlin Wall, there was also a militarized border in the north on the sea. On the Baltic Sea. And there were people who escaped there by swimming or building crazy submarines. But also, you know, people lived their lives there with all sorts of constraints. So looking into life and death on the Baltic coast of East Germany. And I'm also in this time when I can't get to Germany like I usually would in the summer. I'm writing some essays about traveling in Germany with my father, something we do every summer, but sadly we can't do this summer.
Well, when the books are done, hopefully we can have you back and you can talk to us about them.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I want to again thank Dr. Harrison for agreeing to come on the show and talk to us about her new book. And for our listeners, the title of the book again is After the Berlin Wall, Memory and the Making of New Germany, 1989 to the Present. I also want to thank everybody for listening today, and we will see you all next time.